Thank you for listening to this podcast from KX93.5, Laguna's only FM. We invite you to listen to more music and talk on our grassroots nonprofit radio station in Laguna Beach, California, from anywhere in the world on KX93.5.com/listen or on our smartphone apps. But right now, here's that podcast from KX93.5.
KXRN LP, Laguna Niguel, Laguna Beach. Member supported KX93.5. This disclaimer is a statement notifying the listening audience that any opinion expressed on the air is not reflective of KX93.5, its management, or its board of directors.
And good morning, Laguna Beach, and welcome to Moody with Dr. Sage. I'm your host, Kim Sage. I'm a clinical psychologist, and I have a show here called Moody with Dr. Sage, where we talk about our moods, our minds, and our real lives. And today, we're going to continue to extend what we've been talking about, this idea of embracing your messy and beautiful story so that you can really live your best life. So today I'm going to play a little bit of an interview with Glennon Doyle. Many of you probably already know her. She's a very incredible woman. She has some great stories to tell and about her life. She really is a truth teller about things in her life. And regardless of whether you agree with her religion or spirituality or politics, at the core, she has a really important message, which is why you must embrace and love your story. And so I'm going to play an interview with on Oprah's Super Soul Sunday, which I've already said before, Oprah's probably the reason why I'm a therapist. I think that the whole idea of her show was to just tell people's real stories. And, so we don't feel so alone in the world. And while I am 100 times far in the direction of Oprah in terms of my abilities, my passion for the show is the same thing. I want to share information and resources about, the real truth of our lives and the things we don't really talk about. So to introduce you to Glennon Doyle, if you don't know her, I'm just going to read to you her intro on her website, momastery.com, momastery.com. Glennon's got books and podcasts, and she's often traveling. So I'm going to extend upon what she says after this interview. But she says, "For 20 years, I was lost to bulimia and alcoholism and bad love and drugs. I suffered. My family suffered. I had a relatively magical childhood, which added an extra layer of guilt to my pain and confusion. Glennon, why are you all jacked up when you have no excuse to be all jacked up? My guess is that I was born with an extra dose of sensitivity to love and pain. I didn't want to walk through the battlefield of life naked. So when I was 10 years old, I made it my own little world called addiction, and I hid there for decades. I felt safe. No one could touch me. On Mother's Day 2002, unwed and addicted, I found myself holding a positive pregnancy test. For the first time in my life, I wanted something more than I wanted to be numb. I decided to become a mother and vowed to never again have another drink, cigarette, drug, unhealthy relationship, or food binge. I found myself marrying my son's father. 14 years later, I'm mother to 3 kids, a couple of mutts, and 2 of the most majestic banyan trees you've ever seen. I'm a grateful member of this community of truth tellers, a Sunday school teacher, a number one New York Times best-selling author, speaker, activist, and the founder and president of Together Rising, a nonprofit that has raised over $14 million for vulnerable women and children. Underneath and on top of it all of that, I'm a recovering everything. I am prouder of that title than I am of any other. Every morning I open my eyes and immediately understand that I am still that girl on the bathroom floor, holding that pregnancy test like a terrifying invitation, trying to decide whether to stay down on the cold floor or get up and show up for my life. Most days I decide to show up because I was right when I was little. Life is brutal, but it's also beautiful. Brutiful, I call it. Life's brutal and beautiful are woven together so tightly that they can't be separated. Reject the brutal, reject the beauty. So now I embrace both, and I live well and hard and real." So I'm going to play her interview with Oprah, and here it is, and I'll be back.
I'm Oprah Winfrey. Welcome to Super Soul Conversations, the podcast. I believe that one of the most valuable gifts you can give yourself is time, taking time to be more fully present. Your journey to become more inspired and connected to the deeper world around us starts right now. I think Glennon Doyle is a breath of fresh air and a name you should know. She's a new kind of spiritual teacher who's striking a chord with millions. Glennon first gained a worldwide following as the beloved blogger who bared her soul on her wildly popular website, momastery.com. Glennon's book, Love Warrior, is the biggest, loudest, wildest, truest thing she's ever put out in the world. I chose Love Warrior for my book club because of its bone marrow truth and the refreshing way Glennon describes her path to God and to her core self.
I was struck by this, what you talk about in the very beginning of Love Warrior, about being a pretty little girl. And I was like, wow, gee, because pretty was not a word that I would ever have used or anyone would have used to describe myself as a little girl. I always thought the pretty little girls always had the life that I wish I could have. And so reading Love Warrior and hearing what it felt like to be pretty, and then to feel like you lost that, that your identity was that. So let me just, I love this when you say, I begin to understand that beauty warms people and smart cools people. I also understand that being loved for beauty is a tenuous situation for a girl. How old were you when you realized that?
Well, I was probably 10, because 10 is when I became bulimic.
10, you became bulimic, but then there's a, you start the book talking about, you know, going to the ball games and being there with your father and your father's arms and your mother's smile and walking in and everybody always saying, what a beautiful little girl, what a beautiful little girl.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the world wants girls to be pretty and small and quiet. And as long as I was able to stay pretty and small and quiet, everything would be fine. And the second I figured out that how can you be a successful girl if the purpose of being human and growing is to grow and to find your voice? So it's a setup, right? If to be a successful girl, you have to be small and quiet, but to be human, you have to become big and have a voice.
And so everywhere you would go and people would say how pretty you were, you came to understand that that was a responsibility to people, right? That they somehow had an expectation from you.
Yeah, or maybe it was like a power. I don't know.
Yeah, like it was a power.
Yeah. But I'm also a girl who, so when I was a senior in high school, I was admitted to a mental hospital for bulimia and depression. And then the week after I got out of the mental hospital, I was sitting on a homecoming car, waving in the homecoming parade with a sash across me that said, leading leader of my class. And I remember sitting there thinking, where do these people want to follow me to? But it didn't matter because I was following the rules on the outside, you know? And so that's when I figured out, like, people who need help often look like people who don't need help.
Right.
The rules of high school are, you know, be pretty, be quiet, follow the powerful boy's lead. Like, I actually was. I was following the underground rules of high school pretty well. It's just not a, those aren't the real rules of the world.
So let's start with pretty, pretty, pretty. Everybody tells you everywhere you go. Family looks perfect. Everybody thinks everything's perfect. And then you're in the room with cousins. I think you were about 8, right?
Yeah.
And you see them flitting around and they are small. And you realize that you are growing. And you feel what?
Afraid, other, scared, lonely. I was really self-conscious. I think there are some kids who just aren't self-conscious. I see them. I just always was very self-conscious of my body, and I felt other. I felt separate.
Well, of course you would if you are objectified at a very young age, where everywhere you go, people tell you how good you look. So then you have that expectation for yourself as a little girl. Well, I've got to be pretty, otherwise people are not going to notice me or pay attention to me.
Yeah, and anytime you have an identity that's in something that can be taken from you, you're afraid.
You're afraid.
So I think I was afraid because I knew that being a pretty girl is something that could be taken from me, and it's taken from everyone when they're 12. Right? The end of the game was soon. I could feel it coming.
Everybody had that duckling stage coming. Yeah, where we all look like we just came from part platypus, part duck, part, yeah.
How do we make it through?
Sheesh,
it's an early humbling. I don't know. I just think I was a really sensitive kid, and I think I figured out that addiction was a place to hide. It's a hiding place. Mm-hmm. You know, love and pain are so risky. And I think I figured out early that I was someone who couldn't handle either. And so why not hide? You know, addiction is just a little hiding place where sensitive people can go so we don't have to be touched by love or pain.
Yeah. And there was another epiphanal moment. I don't know where this is in the journey. But I think you were standing outside church and someone came up to you and said, you know, you're just so perfect. You're just so perfect. And you are looking confused, right? They're saying you're just so perfect. And you came to the conclusion that when people see...
Yeah. Well, I mean, because of what our culture tells you is success, if you are a person who happens to be thin and is wearing, you know, nice jeans, people think that you have all of the universe's secrets in your pocket.
Right.
You know, and it's very interesting.
Oh, my God, especially if you got the jeans.
Oh, forget it.
Forget it.
If you have on skinny jeans, you have zero. The rain has never fallen upon your head.
No. Yes. But I was saying to producers, it's just changed. Now it's you have on... skinny jeans, you have on, you know, you have, the, you know, you're driving the right car. Every generation has its standard. It used to be, you know, you're in the church, your kids come to Sunday school, they're polite in front of people, you make the best Jell-O mold. You know, we change whatever it is. But
I'm so glad it's not the Jell-O
mold. I'm so glad it's not the Jell-O with the fruit in it. Yes.
Yeah. I think that's what... And we all have these, you know, perfect outsides, or we try to make our outsides perfect. But I think that's what was so powerful to me the first time I went, my first recovery meeting.
Yes.
After high school, Glennon says her bulimia was replaced with a toxic mix of booze, boys, and drugs. The stranglehold of drug and alcohol addiction was so strong, Glennon says she never allowed herself to ever come down from a high. She lived in near total darkness, avoiding daylight, and waking only after the sun had gone down. In her first memoir, Carry On Warrior, Glennon described her rock-bottom moment when she was 26, hungover on the bathroom floor, holding a pregnancy test and shaking.
When I found out I was pregnant and decided that I wanted to be a mother more than I wanted to be numb, that's the first time I wanted anything more than I wanted to just be numb. And my sister picked me up off the floor of the bathroom and took me to my first recovery meeting. And I remember sitting around the circle and thinking, oh my God, these are the first honest people I've ever met in my life. These are my people. They are all jacked up. They are.
Whew. A lot of problems. Yeah.
But we're all jacked up, right? Mm-hmm. And their outsides matched their insides. Mm-hmm. It was a relief. Mm-hmm. Sitting at that meeting was the first time where I figured out, maybe I can do this. Maybe I can be a sober... vertical human being. Those honest people.
So for you, the addiction, the bulimia, you were running from what? You were afraid of what?
I was afraid of pain. I really thought of myself as broken. I thought of myself as someone who could not handle pain. And so I hid from it.
And what had broken you?
Listen, I just think this is, I used to, nothing. I used to think I was broken. I wrote in my first book that I was broken. And now it just makes me mad every time. This is why writing words in books is so precarious.
Because?
This is why Jesus only wrote in the sand. Right? Like, I hate that I wrote that. I don't think that I'm broken at all. I think, so this is what I tell people about being sensitive, just being a sensitive human being. I no longer think that I'm a mess. I just think I'm a deeply feeling person in a messy world. Totally different.
Yeah.
You
respond to energy different.
Absolutely.
Many families have children who are the sensitive ones. And a lot of families, I never forget this on the Oprah show years ago. Somebody said, the child who is, there's no such thing as a black sheep of the family. That every black sheep is the person in the family who energetically responded to everything around them in such a way that they absorbed all of the other family's energy, conscious and subconscious, and they absorb everything around them environmentally differently than the rest of the family.
And they're a gift.
And they're a gift. Yes.
As opposed to considering the fact that these might be sensitive people who are responding to a broken world.
Yes, yes, right. Yes. You say, we, especially women, find out very early in life that there is a system to telling the truth that splits us in two.
Mm-hmm.
Explain that.
Yeah.
Sister Glennon?
I mean, I felt split into my entire life. There is the part of me on the outside that's saying the things that I'm supposed to say.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm fine.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fine. Everything's good. Marriage, it's like Disney. Parenting, fulfilled.
Yeah.
And then there's the part on the inside of me that's like scared and lonely and confused a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think that happens is I really think that we are all truth tellers. I think we are just made to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that people who, it is very hard for the world to hear the truth from a woman. It's easier for the world to hear the truth from a man.
Yes.
But since negative emotions are less acceptable from a woman.
Right.
We end up sometimes telling our truth in different ways than words. Dangerous ways. Like, this was the food for me, the booze for me. I think we tell the truth with something. Everybody tells the truth with something, whether it's, they say I'm not fine with a credit card, or they say I'm not fine with overeating, or they say I'm not fine with booze or sex,
yes,
or
yes, yes.
What, unkindness or whatever it is, which is why it's so powerful when you can integrate those two selves and tell the truth, the story of what's going on your inside with your words.
Absolutely. But you also say that every little girl is told at some point that the world does not want to see the ugly, afraid, secret version of who they really are.
Oh, that's absolutely true.
They just want to hear, I'm fine.
Yeah, but the other truth is that some people are desperate for it, like they need air.
Right.
That it's worth all the rejection you get when you're real, because someone, because every time you tell the truth, it just, you know, clears the field for other people to tell their truth.
Okay.
And then the truth gets bigger and bigger.
And is that, was the breakthrough the first time you went to a recovery meeting where you just went, oh, wow, these are my people?
Because I thought, oh, this is the way you can do life.
Mm-hmm.
You actually don't have to do the shiny, perfect thing. You can get through life by showing up and saying, okay, actually, is this hard? And I need help. I need a higher power. And I need you. And that's how we're going to get through this thing together. I mean, I wanted to cry at the end of the first recovery meeting when I figured out that you have to leave. Like, this is, you're going to send me back in there?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know? And so I just wanted to make my whole life into just a recovery meeting.
Mm. And in many ways, you now have, mm-hmm. wouldn't you say?
Mm-hmm.
When did you first decide that you were going to blog it?
Well,
what was behind that?
I tried to tell the truth in the real life.
Yes.
A few times.
Yeah.
I remember after I brought my littlest home,
mm-hmm.
I was staying home with my three kids because that is an amazing idea for someone with high anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
I was just dripping with babies and I remember going to a play date
mm-hmm.
and the woman turned to me and said, so how do you feel? Like, you've got the three babies at home, how do you feel? And I thought, awesome, we're going to talk about how we feel. And I remember, because I'm a metaphor girl, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'd been working on a metaphor for how I felt. So mm-hmm. I said, okay, I don't know a lot about science, but I know there's like two different kinds of volcanoes. And the first volcano is an active volcano, and the second one is a dormant one. And the dormant volcano looks calm on the outside, but inside she's like bubbling with boiling hot lava that at any moment could just explode and mm-hmm. kill everyone in the vicinity. That's how I feel as a stay-at-home mom all day. And by the way, that's perfect. That's exactly how it feels. It's an amazing metaphor. But everybody just silence and just like wide eyes.
Uh-huh.
And I had that moment where I was like, oh, we're not doing that here.
Oh, you didn't mean how I really felt.
So then I said, okay, what I meant is that I just love every minute of it. I hate when they sleep. I just stare at them. And I think if there's one word that would describe how I feel as a mother, it would be fulfilled. That's how I feel, is fulfilled. And then we ended the moment. And I thought, okay, well, we're not gonna be honest at playdates,
uh-huh.
all right?
Uh-huh.
That's a shame. So,
But saying that is what made the other person feel comfortable, feel a sense of relief.
Probably, like, or afraid for me. I don't know. Maybe some calls to people. Like, I don't know.
God, that Glennon's not right. Something's not right with her.
So then, I actually did. I was desperate for a place to tell the truth. Uh-huh. I knew I needed that for my sobriety. Uh-huh. You know, to just stay naked and unashamed, like, this is me, and I don't think it's a mistake. So I knew I needed a place to tell the truth, and I actually did start feeling this invitation to start writing. Mm-hmm. Like, it felt like an annoying tap from God, like, really? Get off the couch and start writing. But I ignored it because I just love watching TV. So one day I was passing the computer and I saw this thing going on Facebook called the 25 Things.
Yes.
So my friends were just like making lists about things about themselves, and I thought, awesome, I can make a list. So I sat down at the computer.
Oh, the 25 things you don't know about me.
Right. Yes. Right. Okay. Yes. Uh-huh. And so I walked away, and 2 hours later I came back, and Oprah, there were like, my list had been shared all these times from my personal page, and I had 27 new emails. And I thought, something.
And your sister called?
6 times.
Yeah.
So that's our bat signal for, like, I've done something inappropriate that's going to require a lot of cleanup on her part.
Yeah.
So then that's when I thought, oh, I really should have read someone else's list before I did mine. So this is my number 6. I'm a recovering food and alcohol addict, but I still find myself missing booze in the same twisted way that we can miss people who repeatedly beat us and leave us for dead.
That was your number 6. Okay.
It's true.
Mm-hmm. True.
But here's my friend Sarah's number 6. My favorite snack food is hummus.
Wow.
Oprah, all of mine were like that. Like, all of that was like the most lighthearted one. And so I thought, oh, we're not doing that here either. We weren't doing that.
Yeah.
And I wanted to die. I just wanted to just take it all back. But then later that night, I started opening those emails from people. And they were from people who I had known my whole life, but I had never really known. Because these emails said things like, oh my gosh, Glennon, I just read your list, and I've been bulimic for 12 years, and I've never told anyone. Glennon, I just read your list. My husband and I are struggling. We don't know where to turn. Glennon, I just read your list. My dad's depressed. And on and on. And then they'd all be like, I mean, not all of it, because whoa, but like number 4.
Yes.
All of them would say that as a disclaimer. And I thought, this is interesting. This is like, this truth-telling is something that can unlock people. You know, like, if we're really meant to connect with each other, then what are we wasting our time?
Yeah.
With this other surface
pretense
stuff.
Thing, yeah.
Yeah.
What are we doing?
Yeah, and I felt connected. Mm-hmm. I felt connected, like the real me to the other real other people. You know, the stuff we mm-hmm. were meant to help each other carry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, and if everybody were being honest, it would be so much easier for everybody to carry it. Because everybody who's going through something, even listening to us now, you think you're the only one. Mm. That's why I started the Oprah Show, you know. Mm. And what I said on the very first day of the show, I want people who are watching the show to know that you're not alone. That was my intention, to know that there's somebody who's felt what you're feeling.
When Glennon met her husband, Craig Melton, she says she had only been sober 10 nights before they decided to marry. After the birth of their second child, Craig admitted to Glennon he'd been unfaithful throughout their 13-year marriage. Glennon says she sat in stillness to process what happened, but ultimately chose to share their private journey with her readers.
When you made a big decision, whether or not you were going to talk about Craig in this way, where you were going to out your marriage,
yeah.
where you were going to out the infidelity. So you had been feeling for a very long time, and I know, if you're just us talking about this, there are a lot of other people who can relate to this story. Mm-hmm. You're feeling for a long time the lack of intimacy, connection, blaming yourself for what that is, right?
Yeah.
And then you went to therapy.
Yeah.
You're going to therapy. Mm-hmm. You're going to therapy to try to fix that.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to therapy to try to fix him.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was doing there.
Yeah.
But then one day in therapy, oh my gosh, we were just sitting there. I thought we were just going to talk about something mundane. Mm-hmm. I don't know. And yeah, he said, I have to tell you something, or I don't
there
know.
There is something about. I have to tell you.
Yeah. The second he said that, I was like, this is the time in life when everything falls apart. I just knew.
You knew it?
Yeah.
And then Craig said?
He said, I've been unfaithful. And it wasn't, or there have been other women. I think those were the words, there have been other women. Mm-hmm. And so for us, it wasn't a one-time thing.
So when your husband says that, like, does your heart stop beating? What's going through your head in that moment? Are you thinking life as I know it is about landslide.
Yeah. Like everything's being pulled out from under you.
Mm-hmm.
Because now I can look back and see that there was plenty wrong, but I didn't know at the time. And whenever anyone had told me that they didn't know, I thought they were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the signs are always there.
Yeah. I always thought, come on. But I really didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that day we separated. I just said, get your stuff and get out. And I don't know. I mean, the lucky thing for me was that I remember knowing. I mean, I'd been through rock bottom before. Like, I'd been through a serious, it felt like an eviction from my life. All right, it felt like someone had handed me an eviction notice from mm-hmm. my life. Like, this little life that you've created that you love. Here you go, you're out. But I'd had that before because the pregnancy test was an eviction from my life.
Mm-hmm.
The difference was that my life sucked with the first eviction. I mean, I was a drunk.
Mm-hmm.
So that it felt like being invited to something better. This one didn't feel like that. This one felt like just...
Landslide,
yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, the way I think about rock bottom now, whether it's the rock bottom of my marriage or my individual rock bottom, is that rock bottom is a crisis, okay? It's a crisis, and everyone wants to avoid crisis. But what crisis means literally is to sift, okay? Like a child who goes to the beach, lifts up the sand and watches all the sand fall away, hoping mm-hmm. that there's treasure left over.
Yes.
And that's what crisis does, has done for me. It comes into my life, and I have to watch everything fall away that I thought that I needed
mm-hmm.
so I can find out what's left over. And what was left over the first time and what was left over the second time is really my faith and my hope and my love. Those are the things that can't be taken from me, right? And I think that's why women who have been to rock bottom, I think that's why they're the brave ones and the kind ones and the wise ones.
That's right.
And the ones who can laugh at the days to come.
Yes.
Because they're the ones who know that the only things you really need are also the things that can't be taken from you. And so fear goes.
Down there at rock bottom.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I think that really what happened when crisis came in and stripped me of that perfect mom and wife thing, I think I found a truer identity. I really do. And I think I figured out that the only identity that I will ever be allowed to claim is child of God. Like, that's what I was named when I was born. That's who I'll be when I die. And that's the only identity that I have that nobody can come and change or take. And that has made me a little less fearful.
That's so powerful.
I never believed, Oprah, ever, mm-hmm. that I needed to save my marriage to save myself. Like, I just always knew that the end of the road was redemption, either way. Mm-hmm. That if we stayed together, that was redemption. And that if we separated and used the pain to heal ourselves, that was redemption.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important for me to say that I think that sometimes if a woman has a choice between saving her soul and saving her marriage, she needs to save her soul. That if your soul or your body or your mind are being threatened in any way by your marriage, then you just go. And you know deeply that there is a big difference between leaving a marriage and leaving God.
Mm-hmm.
That there is a huge difference between leaving a man and leaving God.
Yeah.
Because God is every bit of the God of woman as God is of man.
Yeah. Yeah. The tweet is, there's a difference between saving your marriage and saving your soul.
Mm-hmm.
You save your soul.
Amen. And God will go with you.
And God will go with you.
You leave your marriage, God just comes
yeah.
with you.
But also beautiful that either way, redemption would have come if you stayed. Mm. Redemption would have come if you'd gone.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And that's when I got my Be Still tattoo, because it seemed like at that time there was just voices everywhere. You know, there were voices of people, even good people wanted to help me, but everybody had an opinion of what mm-hmm. I should do. You should stay, you should go, you should... And there was my only hope during that time was that I knew if I got very still for just a few minutes a day, that I would know what to do next.
How did you know that?
I think, and this is the best way I can describe it because it's so hard to describe. When it's my fear or when it's my mind, it's words. My mind loves words, 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 words. We're making this excuse to stay. We're arguments. When it's God, it's just a knowing. It's just lower. It's deep. It's a voice that doesn't speak in words. It's like you can be saying words and the knowing comes and is opposite of that.
Absolutely.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
So the fear in the mind is words.
That's why he said, be still and know.
Be still and know. Exactly.
Yes.
And you know. And yes. The reason for the going and the coming is because the knowing doesn't give you a five-year plan. Like, it just only tells you the next right thing. And so today it was stay away. Don't go back for comfort. Don't abandon yourself. Don't do it. And then a week later it was try. You know, it was different. Constantly, but I had to check in to get the knowing.
That's right.
I don't know what's going to happen. I, for one, know that I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, right? Mm-hmm. So the be still and know, it's not about right or wrong. It's not about doing the right thing or the wrong thing. It's about doing the precise thing that's directed to you.
I was struck by something happened to one of, I think it was Chase,
mm-hmm.
who had come to you, and he asked you, Mommy, why does God make things die?
Mm-hmm.
Why do we lose things that we love?
Mm-hmm.
And your answer to him struck me so. Share that, will you?
Yeah, and it goes with the marriage thing too. I mean, I don't think that God gives us love, other people or animals, or so that we have them forever. I think that God gives us love so that it changes us. And I think that so that we grow. And I think that that is how I feel about marriage, too. What I told him about is fish.
Mm-hmm.
because, you know, I really think that, and when we bring up the idea of death, things have to die for new life. I think of love and marriage now as, you know, plants. Like, we have annuals and we have perennials, right? And the annual plant blooms for a season, and then the winter comes and takes it out and doesn't bloom again. Perennial plant blooms and the winter comes and it goes away and then comes back. And I think that's what loves are. Like, some loves are just meant for a season and they aren't going to bloom again, right? But what happens with that kind of love is that it goes back into the soil to create richer, newer soil for the next love to bloom, right? It's not that it was wasted. No love is wasted and love never fails. Whether your love is an annual or a perennial, the result of both are new life.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's what I think. I think love just comes to love
change
anything.
You and to make you better.
Yeah.
So if you've had it in your life, if you had love, however it showed up for you, it was there to elevate you, to change you, and to make you better.
That's exactly right.
And you know what I loved? I loved Chase's response to that. He said, I can believe that.
Yeah. That's great.
I think that's great.
Sometimes I give them faith answers and they're like, come on. But that one was believable.
I can believe that.
Yeah.
What are you most proud of yourself for right now?
Oh, without a doubt, my sobriety. I'm so excited. I'm a person who, for the first half of my life, was so scared of pain.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran from it in so many ways. I just thought I was a person that couldn't handle it. And now I think of pain as like I feel like a scientist who has like discovered this new material that inside mm-hmm. of it has life-changing properties, you know? Like, do you remember those commercials where like the second things got kind of uncomfortable,
yeah.
a red button would come up and someone would hit it, and then everybody would just be transported out of the
That's
stressful
right.
place into this pain-free place? So what happens when we transport ourselves out of the pain is that we miss all of our transformation. Because everything that we need to know to become the people we were meant to be is actually inside of our hot loneliness. So when we jump out of it, when we jump off our mat, we are like caterpillars who jump out of our cocoon right before we would have become butterflies. You know, so all of those easy buttons I was using, mine were food and booze and drugs, but you know, some people's are sex and shopping and unkindness.
Overworking and unkindness.
I mean,
yeah.
Oh yeah. My gosh, because when I feel someone's been unkind, I know that all that just happened is that they just felt the hot loneliness, but they don't know how to be still with it. So they just treat it like a hot potato and pass it on to the next person.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But pain is not a hot potato. Pain is a traveling professor, and it just goes and knocks on everyone's door. And the smartest people I know are the people who say, come in and just don't leave until you've taught me what I need to know.
To their pain.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody's running away from it. We should be running in it, towards it.
Towards it. Everybody's right. Afraid of their pain, but what they should be afraid of is the easy buttons.
Yes.
Because that's where the suffering comes in, right? Pain is mandatory for all of us. It's what teaches us. But suffering is optional. That's what I did for the first 25 years. That's what happens when we try to skip over the pain, when we try to, like, get to the resurrection before the crucifixion, right?
That's right.
All of our suffering is.
Yeah.
Is trying to rise before the fall.
You got to get through Saturday.
Yes.
Before you can hit Sunday morning.
That's right.
Yeah, you got to get through
Saturday.
That's
the deal.
Yeah. You are very wise. You are like a super soul vision.
Oh, I got a super soul clap. Now I can just die happy.
Super Soul Sunday. Yay, Glennon. What a great job.
Oh, thank you so much, Oprah.
Fantastic.
And welcome back to Moody with Dr. Sage. You were listening to a Super Soul Sunday interview between Oprah and Glennon Doyle. And the title of that one is The Power of Embracing Your Messy, Beautiful Life. And that is what we're talking about today. We're talking about how to embrace your messy and beautiful life and story and why you need to do that. And I'm going to talk about that in a minute. So once again, that was Glennon Doyle. She has a great book called Love Warrior, another one called Carry On Warrior, and she's a blogger on momastery.com. She has an organization called Together Rising, and just a bunch of great ways of thinking about things and explaining things and exploring things. So she's one of those people like Brené Brown, and of course they're I'm sure quite closely connected. There's interviews I believe with them too, but someone worth checking out. And so the idea is that our lives are messy, and they are not always so beautiful. And I say this a lot, but living in Southern California especially, although I think it's true for everyone, given Instagram and Facebook, and all the studies that support that the longer you spend on social media, the higher the depression rates and the anxiety rates, because you're watching other people's lives look so amazing, and they're not always so amazing. Doesn't mean you can't enjoy your hit of social media, but it is important to be mindful of your exposure. And some of us are more sensitive to that than others, obviously. So the idea is that we are often rewarding each other for what's happening on the outside. And my question to you this morning is, where do you focus on the outside? And what do you tell your children or your partners about the outside versus the inside? So the next time maybe that you want to tell someone you love, a child or a partner, maybe something about the way they look, maybe it's go wash your face or take a shower, or you look so beautiful, or you want to focus on something they've done, something they achieved, how they won a trophy or got a good grade, you know, that's all important and that's great. But I also think it's incredibly powerful to try telling them something about the qualities that you love about them on the inside, where it is messy. Something about their goodness or their kindness, how open they are to new experiences, or maybe something about how strong and powerful they are, or about their sense of humor. You know, those things that you can't see when you roll out of bed. We all need to be reminded about what those things are, and there's nothing more powerful than telling someone you love, hey, I noticed this about you, I see this about you, and I want to honor it. Because the thing that I think is true, too, is Glennon talks about all of us are jacked up on the inside. And I think that that's definitely true for me. It's true for everyone I've ever met. We are all struggling in different ways and to different degrees. But I think, in general, we're not taught to embrace our pain, to not be afraid of our pain. And so when we do that, the consequences of that are numbing, and feeling ashamed and unworthy, not letting ourselves be vulnerable with people that we love. And we do this with addictions. It can be things like work or porn or sex or control or food or substances. And we find ways to sort of numb out. But as I've said before, and you know, it's kind of just makes perfect sense. If you numb the pain, you also numb the joy. And so obviously, I think also if you're a more sensitive person, your tendency to want to numb is going to be even higher than someone who isn't. And I love this conversation they were having in the interview with Oprah and Glennon Doyle, talking about how in every family, there's often the most or more sensitive child. And it's interesting because this is often what we call in therapy the identified patient. And what that means is that's the person who's everyone is focusing all of the wound, the issue, the trauma on, the difficulty. And often that person on the outside looks like the most chaotic person. But often this is the person in the family system holding the pain and acting it out. And so obviously, if you know you are a more sensitive child or a more sensitive human being, it's going to be even more difficult to navigate the world because so much comes at you. And I have a great book recommendation or Audible. I've used this one a lot in my practice. It's called The Empath's Survival Guide, Life Strategies for Highly Sensitive People. And it's by a woman named Judith Orloff, O-R-L-O-F-F-M-D. I will say, and I always say this, and no offense to Judith, there's some of it that might be a little too out there for you in terms of the way she talks about things. But like all the books I always recommend or anything I read, I always think about it as taking the spirit of it. And I always say this, not taking everything literally. People often write books with strong opinions. And so if you can gather the spirit of something and make it useful for you, I think that's really helpful. So I really do love this book, especially the first part of it when she describes what it's like to be a sensitive person. And if you are a sensitive person, you'll understand that everything sort of invades you. You often think too much. You feel too much. You analyze too much. And this often comes out in anxiety and depression and things like that, OCD, right? Not that everyone who has struggles are necessarily all sensitive, but it certainly makes sense that even if you are sensitive, your risk for addiction is probably higher because the pain just feels like too much. So that's a great resource. I like this idea of owning our truth. And I thought it was really, it's so interesting as she talks about that experience with the play date where she's at a play date with a bunch of moms and she's trying to stand in her truth. And a mom says, oh, you know, how are you doing with your third baby? And Glennon starts to describe the difference between an active volcano and a dormant volcano and how she really feels like the dormant volcano about to explode at all times as a stay-at-home mom. And obviously in that scenario, she describes that was not what the woman was asking. It was really more about telling me how fulfilled you are and how meaningful it is. And not that being a stay-at-home mom or a stay-at-home dad isn't those things. But the truth is that it's so much harder, whether you're the person who has all the financial responsibility in the relationship or you're the one with the kids or you're both doing both. It's just hard. And I'm not saying we walk around, you know, whining about everything, but finding people we trust to share our truth with is a powerful way to stay open and connected to ourselves and other people. Because inside, we're often scared and confused. Whether you're a woman or a man doesn't really matter, right? I think we're all struggling with the daily requirements of our lives. So one of the things I also tell people is, you know, being vulnerable is about finding people you can be safely vulnerable with. So it's not about vomiting your truth on people all the time, although sometimes the answer to how are you and you want to say I'm horrible may not be the best response to the person checking out your groceries. But I think it's okay to say, I'm okay. You know, how are you? I don't know that we have to always share everything, but I think it's important to find people that we can share our truth with and to feel safe. So you don't want to tell your deepest story to someone you don't know very well, who might turn around and tell it to someone else. It is important that people earn your trust and earn your vulnerability. I like this idea, too, of what I think was back in 2009 when she made this list of people, you know, 25 things you don't know about me. I would encourage you to do that now for yourself, is to make a list of your truths, of your pain, of what makes you feel vulnerable, and of what you don't say out loud. And I don't care if you ever share it, but maybe just putting it down in front of you and then challenging yourself to explore how am I dealing with these things? Am I dealing with them? Am I avoiding them? Where can I create a plan of action to dive more deeply into this issue because it's affecting my life in a negative way? Certainly you could take that listen to therapy or share it with a friend and agree to do it together and challenge each other. But I think owning your truth is really the first step. All of us are afraid of our pain, generally speaking. I don't know many people who grew up, especially in earlier generations, being taught how to talk about death, how to talk about loss, how to deal with those things, how to deal with feeling self-conscious or being incredibly sensitive or thinking too much or feeling too much. Most of us have been walking around numbing those feelings and hiding them because it also just feels like way too much to share with the world. But I would challenge you and ask you, where are you running from your pain and what is the running doing to you? What is it doing to people that you love? Is your running away from your pain causing addiction? Is it creating anxiety or depression? Is it making you so focused or you or your partner or your children on a need to achieve that you're so busy trying to control and manage and predict and keep that wall up of everything's fine that maybe you're missing something in your life? Maybe all of that need to hide your mess is holding you back from living in the beautiful, light-filled, messy place of life, not just in the dark, hidden corners where we don't clean the dirt. And maybe all of this is keeping you from being real and vulnerable. And I keep saying it, and as I keep mentioning, you know, where all these ideas come from in terms of Brené Brown, but I think she really is the person who put words around this most beautifully, that what makes us real makes us vulnerable. And vulnerability and owning our story and our mess is the key to experiencing joy and love and creativity. And here's one of my favorite quotes as we end the show about vulnerability. And this is really the essence of the show today, about embracing and owning your story, your messy story, finding ways to be real and authentic in safe places and in safe ways. Because I can promise you that trying to keep that wall up, something will come along in your life and knock it down. And what are you going to do then? Or maybe it already has and you don't know what to do about it. And you think, I just don't know how to be different. I hear you, but I don't know how to change it. Well, you can't change it until you start to at least accept it and own it. And I know that sounds like a cliche in those words we use, but it really is true. If you can't own your truth, you certainly can't look at it. So here's the quote. Owning our story can be hard, but not nearly as difficult as spending our lives running from it. Embracing our vulnerabilities is risky, but not nearly as dangerous as giving up on love and belonging and joy. The experiences that make us the most vulnerable are the ones we have to look at. Only when we are brave enough to explore the darkness will we discover the infinite power of our light. So ask yourself today, where are you running from your truth? Where can you own your story? Where can you pull someone into your life that you can share that with? And what is it doing to you? And what is it going to continue to do to your life if you don't? You're probably hurting yourself, but you're probably also hurting people that love you. So I would highly encourage you to check out Glennon Doyle, check out Brené Brown, go watch some Oprah Soul Sunday Conversations. I mean, all these things are free. They don't cost a dime. And just let those ideas soak in and challenge yourself to think about them in a new way. You've been listening to Moody with Dr. Sage. I'm your host, Kim Sage. I'm here live every Sunday at 8 a.m. on KX 93.5, and I hope you have a beautiful, peace-filled Sunday. But if you're not having a peace-filled Sunday, I wish you a day filled with love and warmth around you, maybe just letting someone in if that might change this day. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.